keeps her depot outline in that big old brain of hers, deadly by design. She's coming for your experts, a built-in death machine, destroyer for the justice team. There's no deposition she will decline. A modern-day suffragette, well-versed in death threats.
And ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this episode of the Justice Team Podcast. We are coming to you live. We are in sunny San Diego. Very sunny day today. We are in a trailer. It's like a little bit of a hot box, but we're pretty cool in here. But we are super excited. We have a national, well-known rock style trial lawyer, and we also have Bruce Brillet on. We have Molly McKibben and Bruce Brillet from the firm of Green, Brillet and Wheeler, prolific trial lawyers, the best in the nation, out of Santa Monica, California. Bruce, why don't you introduce yourself? Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Bruce Brillet. Pleasure to be here today. Thank you.
All right. And Molly, thank you for coming on. Can you introduce yourself as
well? Thank you. I'm Molly McKibben. I work with Bruce.
We also have our CFO / bartender here, Murata Behan.
Yes, I apologize for the dry podcast today.
Yeah, we couldn't really get that liquor license to be out in public in San Diego.
Yeah, we tried, but it's just going to be done in 24 hours.
Turns out. A little more complicated.
Yeah.
So we want to talk about a few things, but first I want to talk a little bit about, I want to talk about your firm, okay, because it's a lot of firm that younger lawyers like me have looked up to, try to model our firm after. So, Bruce, I have to ask you, how many years has your firm been together?
Wow, about 45 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a long time. A lot of people have worked there for a long time and tried a lot of cases, yeah. Helped a lot of people.
And how many cases you think your firm has tried? Best estimate.
It's hundreds, maybe in the thousands.
Wow.
It's a lot of cases.
I mean, and it's impressive because a lot of, when you're representing people and it's not a corporation, usually these firms only last a few years or they break apart and things like this, but 45 years.
Yeah, you know, what we do is trial lawyers, as you well know, have large egos. And so what we
No!
It's true.
What?
I mean, you know, flash.
Shocking. Blasphemy.
Hold the presses. Here it is. But what we try to do is to give everybody space. So allow all the egos to grow and develop and work together and be proud that we're doing it all together.
A true ego system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, an ego system, yeah. Wow.
And then how did you find this young rock star?
You know, notwithstanding the fact that she went to USC.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Right on.
Oh, boy. Uh-huh.
But that was only undergraduate, and then she went to Pepperdine. She came on with us.
That's where they have the best legal education.
That's what I understand.
That, yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. And she was the best of the best. And so we got a chance to bring her into the office and see the kind of work she did and then offered her a job. And no looking back. She is a rock star.
Molly, you've been there since a clerk.
I have, yeah. I got hired my second year of law school, and then they hired me after I took the bar, which was lovely. And I've been there ever since. I've had a waitressing job and this job, so that's my whole work history.
And I always like to tell my trial lawyers, you want to learn how to talk to people and talk to juries, be a waitress or a bartender.
I'm telling you. Important life skills, dealing with difficult personalities.
I mean, like, working at the firm.
Exactly.
So we're going to talk about one of the most interesting cases that you two have worked on. And I know you guys won. It was you guys won the Trial Lawyer of the Year, the Consumer Advocate Award for this case, right?
That's correct.
So tell us the name of the case and where it was tried.
So the name of the case was Aaron Andrews against actually the Nashville Marriott. And it was tried in Nashville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. To a jury down there. Interestingly, juries down there have to be unanimous. So we needed a 12-0 verdict on the case. And we got a verdict on the case against the hotel on behalf of Aaron Andrews for $55 million.
Wow. And, I mean, it's been over the news and things like this, but it was one of the first cases, I think, brought attention to kind of that privacy issue, right? I mean, has your firm ever handled like these types of cases before? I mean, we never have done a case like that.
Yeah, well, you know, most of our cases or, you know, what we're known for is wrongful death and catastrophic injury cases. But we do some other things as well. We've done cases involving defamation. We've done business torts and so on. And sometimes, you know, defamation cases can have a similar feel. Hmm. It's not as invasive as what happened to Aaron, but it is invasive nonetheless because it is insulting somebody's reputation. And these days with the internet, it spreads all over the place, all over the world, in multiple languages in a heartbeat. So yeah, it's interesting stuff.
How did you get to that? Well, first of all, Molly, can you tell our listeners how you got to the dance? I mean, there's probably a lot of legal hurdles, motions for summary judgment. I mean, how did you actually get there in front of the jury? What was the struggle like?
It definitely was a struggle because we sued Marriott, and then we also sued the companies that actually owned and operated the hotel. And so it was an extreme battle throughout the discovery phase, with Marriott basically saying, we have nothing to do with the hotel, they just have our brand name. And in the end, they did file a motion for summary judgment, and Marriott did get out. So when we were at trial, we were proceeding just against the franchisees who were operating the hotel. And then they actually knocked out the invasion of privacy claim, so we really were going after them based on a negligence
theory.
That
was it, just a negligence
theory? Just a negligence theory, yeah. Because in Tennessee, you have to prove an intentional, harmful act to get invasion of privacy, which everything in this case just basically pointed to they really messed up. It wasn't necessarily malicious. Hmm.
So was the actual, like, criminal, was he part of the verdict form? How did that go down?
Yeah, he was. It took us a really long time to get his deposition. He was moving all over the country, and we finally nailed him down, and he gave a really interesting deposition that was really not in line with the facts of reality or what could have possibly happened. And then we proceeded to trial with him on the verdict form as a defendant, and he didn't show up.
So, I mean, what was the apportionment? Like, how did that break down?
It was 51% on him and 49% on the hotel.
Yeah. But it was only one number. So when the jury returned its verdict, it was returning a number for the damage to her. Mm-hmm. And so they were also returning the number, therefore, against the guy that videotaped her and then put it on the internet.
Wow.
So they had no problem making a large award, and the hotel had to bear their share.
How long did this jury, I mean, they had to be unanimous. How long did the deliberations last?
They deliberated for one day.
Wow.
I argued the case on Friday. They had the case by the end of the day on Friday. They started deliberating Monday morning, and they had a verdict at 5 o'clock.
And how long was your team in Tennessee for that case, for that trial?
It was about 2 weeks for the trial.
Wow.
The judge had full days every day. We had an excellent judge. Superb.
And are there any, for our listeners, that most of ours, we have a national poll, but most of ours are California listeners. Are there any nuances in the law that made things more interesting or difficult for you trying that case?
A lot of the law really tracked what is present in California, so it wasn't entirely new. We did have local counsel, Randy Kennard, out of Nashville, who was amazing, and his office was awesome, kind of keeping us up to speed on the things we needed to do. But it really was pretty similar, other than, having to have a unanimous jury. And then even though the verdict was 51% and 49%, we were able to make an argument post-verdict for joint and several liability under this case in Tennessee, which helped us, I think, with settlement negotiations quite a bit.
Yeah. Molly wrote some excellent briefs in this case.
So case is done. They negotiated the verdict afterwards.
Yep, we can't talk about it.
Well, I know we're not going to talk about it. So let me ask, how did, being a California-based firm, you're in Santa Monica, that big building at the end, Santa Monica Boulevard, how did you get the case?
It was referred to me by the lawyer named Marshall Grossman, who is a top-flight lawyer in Los Angeles, who was helping her with regard to the criminal side of the thing, pursuing the guy that did this to her. And he sent her over to visit with me, and we decided to take the case and do the fight.
How did you get the jury to concentrate on the conduct of the hotel as opposed to the obvious criminal behavior?
Yeah, well, because the criminal guy was not there, most of the testimony had to do with the hotel and how they told the guy without telling her that she was staying there, when she'd be there, and then told her what room she'd be in, and then put him in the room next to her without telling her, and that all of that is foreseeably and predictably going to allow a situation where some kind of harm is going to come. So they should have either not given the information or called her first and said, there's somebody down here that wants to know what room you're in. Should we tell them? But they didn't do any of that. And so the focus was really on the hotel and really about everybody's safety when they go to a hotel.
And your firm has been known for not only winning cases, but having change. I mean, positive change for the consumers, not just that specific case. I mean, you've dealt with some very well-known product cases that have changed things to make them safer. But how, in this case, were you able to educate the public or make change?
Yeah. Well, Molly could explain.
It was interesting because I think by the time we started doing this case, it was always my impression that a hotel is not supposed to share your personal information, not supposed to tell people if you're staying there. But in fact, Marriott did not have such policy at the time.
Marriott always stays as Donald Duck
exactly,
every time he goes.
Exactly.
Dude, you weren't supposed to tell anyone.
Gotta have a
now, now I need a new name.
Was it going to be Daffy?
Maybe Scrooge McDuck.
He has a dream of swimming in gold coins. Mm-hmm.
Ever since a little kid.
Yep.
I always sign in as Molly McKibben.
Oh, my God.
See, that's good.
Never works.
Yeah, you don't look like a Molly. I'm sorry. But yeah, they did not have a policy to do that. And in fact, the woman who took his reservation basically testified, the customer is always right. We give the customer what they want. If they want to know information, we give it to them. And he was like a gold elite or something. So they were even more inclined to give him that information. And after this case, or since the case had started to take place, Marriott did change their policy. And I'm sure now if you go check in anywhere, now I'm hyper paranoid and I'm like waiting when I check in to see if they're going to screw that up or not. And I'm going to have to be like, you're not allowed to say my room number out loud. You're not allowed to like show my room number to anyone else at the desk. So, but they did change that policy, which I think is, you know, as a woman who travels solo for work a lot, I think it's great. It makes me feel a lot safer.
I mean, I heard, didn't Erin Andrews actually become more successful and earn more after this incident happened?
Yeah, she did. And, you know, that was one of the big arguments they made at trial, which I think, I mean, Bruce can probably speak to more, but I think it backfired spectacularly because they were essentially saying, oh, well, since then she's moved to Fox and she's doing Dancing with the Stars. So how could this possibly have hurt her reputation? But, you know, I think as Bruce brought up many times in the trial, when you Google her name, the first thing that autofills is not Erin Andrews sportscaster or Erin Andrews Dancing with the Stars. It's Erin Andrews pee pole video.
Really?
And that is, and we'll talk about more the gentleman that we hired to do the web and analytics for us, but that will not change. That is just what it will always be for her.
Do you ever Google your own name just to see what it predicts next?
Yeah, it just.
What does it say after Molly McKibben?
It says attorney.
Really?
Yeah.
Mine says wife.
Really?
Robert Simon, wife.
Oh, the ladies are looking you up. That's what it's for.
Because my wife is more famous than I am. But really, it's like, oh, that's all I am to you?
Yeah.
I'm known as Mr. Christine Bullock in circles.
Well, you know, one of the ways we handled that was we did not pursue an economic loss claim.
Oh, okay.
It was purely, the whole verdict was non-economic.
So were they able to get into that, her earnings and stuff?
Well, here's what they did. It was sort of subtle, but not very. They couldn't get into how much money she was making, but they got into the point that she continued her career, that she has a lot of endorsement deals and all of these different companies that have hired her and that her career has skyrocketed. They almost didn't need to say that because the jury knew that because they see her on TV all the time. So one of the things that we did was, in closing argument, what I said to the jury was...
Well, I'm going to stop you there because I want our listeners to get a little bit of a feel of Bruce Boylett because I've heard you speak before and it's very captivating. One thing I've learned from you, and I just want to ask you this question now and I try to be better at it, is the diction, the pronunciation when you're in front of a jury with a court reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned that from you, so... I'm going to have you do a quick demonstration on either an opening or a closing in this case. But Marat, how do you know Erin Andrews? I mean, as a non-lawyer, or about this case?
First time I obviously came across her through college football and everything like that. But then, as you guys mentioned, I mean, you get to a point where you're not knowing her as Erin Andrews, but like you said, you just look her up and it's video.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Which for, you know, as a woman who is working in a more male-dominated industry, she already had to work three times as hard as her male peers, and to prove herself to be smart and capable and really amazing on her feet. And then to have all of that kind of brushed away very quickly with this video is heartbreaking.
Absolutely.
Like, that is something that frustrated her.
Were you able to tell
the
story? This is something you were able to tell, her fight?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were extremely proud of the fact that she didn't just curl up in a ball and abandon her career.
And how was she treated by her? I mean, she was at ESPN at that time. I mean, did they treat her fairly?
She got a lot of support from friends and colleagues, from college coaches around the country, but she would get heckled at venues.
Wow.
People would call out, "I've seen you naked. I know how you brush your hair naked," and all that. And
I hear that outside my house too.
I know. Well,
I apologize for that.
Yeah, oh, it's you.
I'm sorry,
Robert. You're not going to get $55 million
yet.
Yeah, no. I mean, I don't think it's my recollection that ESPN was not very supportive of her in general, and I think even we're insinuating that she self-leaked it to get more publicity. Yeah, and she felt really not supported by them, and I think very frustrated.
Well, I don't think she's a Kardashian issue.
No. And this the other thing that I think Bruce brought up too is that, like, obviously Erin Andrews is gorgeous. She's a beautiful woman, but she was one of those girls that would, like, change for PE in a bathroom stall. Like, she wasn't a person who was going to walk around in a bikini all the time. That's just not her personality. And you don't see her really even now. Before you didn't see her in, like, bikini ads or anything like that. So this is, I think, was even more devastating.
I mean, how long did it take you to learn her story? I mean, hours sitting with her? I mean, what was that like, that preparation?
Yeah, you know, it just poured out of her. This was a devastating thing that happened to her in her life. We got to know the family, mom and dad and sister, and got a real sense for who these people are and how this could have such a devastating impact on anybody, but especially to her.
Did she give you any insight into the linebacker situation at Notre Dame?
Yeah.
She actually would not give hot tips. She kept it very close to the breast.
Oh, man.
She'll actually text me every once in a while when the Irish are playing a big game, wishing us good luck. But, you know, she went to Florida, so, you know.
They had their run.
Yeah.
Now they're all in prison. Yeah. whenever Miami plays, when Miami actually plays Notre Dame, what's that name? What's that game name is?
What are they? Yeah. Well, the unofficial name is Catholics versus Convicts.
Correct.
I still have my Catholics versus Convicts shirt. T-shirt. Still have it.
Dude, that's awesome.
That's cool.
All right, so before we get into it, I want to do a quick little monologue with you, but I asked this question to all trial lawyers that we have on here. What are some weird, quirky superstitions that you have when you're in trial, if you have any? Because everybody's got something silly. Come on, Bruce, you go.
I still wear a watch when I'm in trial, that I won in a speech contest when I was 15 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, a bill of a watch, still ticking. And it's been through college with me, law school, everything. And when I'm in trial, I always have that watch on because it always keeps my feet on the ground and reminds me who I am.
Wow. How many trials have you been through with that watch, do you think?
I've lost count. A lot. Every one.
Wow.
Yeah.
How about you, Molly? Come on.
I don't know. I mean, I'm only a 9-year lawyer, so I don't know if I've developed that many. I don't wear any jewelry in court. I did the Jack Daniels trial school, and I remember a guy there, I was wearing a gold watch, and he was coaching all of us and was like, don't wear any jewelry. Just don't. Right.
So. I mean, jurors find reasons to stare at you. They know what handbags you, what shoes you wear.
Exactly.
I always just wear the same shoes every time.
Me too.
Because I don't want to be a talking
Me
lawyer.
Too.
And I wear the same handbag.
You a Gucci guy? I knew it. Knew it about you. All right, Bruce. So can you please give our listeners a little taste of either an opening or a closing? It could just be 5 or 10 minutes.
Well, all right. So let me just tell you a little factoid first. I went into Molly as we were developing the case, and I said to her, you know, we need a metric for this case, something that shows the magnitude of the damage that's been done here, and I'd like you to find the best expert in the country on the internet who can give us some information as to how many people have clicked on and looked at Aaron naked in the hotel room. I was stunned at the number that came back. In the first 7 years, which is how long it took us to get to trial, it had already been viewed 16.9 million times,
wow.
Very conservatively. Then, in the 6 months leading up to the trial, so 7 years later, but before the trial stimulated everybody's interest all over again, in those 6 months before trial, it was being viewed at the rate of once every minute and a half. It was stunning data, which also meant that it was going to go on into the future. So I put on this expert that Molly had found, and he was just excellent. His name is Jim Jansen from Penn State University. And so I was able to do a little bit of damages around that number. So and then I also talked about the fact earlier that we had to deal with the fact that she continued to be successful and that her career had grown and developed. So a couple of points that I made in closing went sort of like this. You know, a lot of people, if this happened to them, would curl up in a ball and never want to be heard from again, let alone someone who's in the public eye. After several weeks of trying to deal with this, Erin decided to continue with the career that she had first found interest in when she was 10 years old, watching Hannah Storm on the sideline of a football game. She said to her dad, "Dad, that's what I want to be." So when this happened to her, she could have hidden, but she didn't. And rather than penalize that with her on the verdict, I think you ought to tell her how proud you are of her, the fact that she continued her career. And you know, these public personas, these public personalities, is sometimes so much different from their private lives. For example, one of my favorite comedians of all time was Robin Williams, and I would have never thought that he would take his own life, because he had his public persona, and then there was what was going on in his personal life. So with Erin Andrews, she has her public persona. We all love her. She's wonderful. You've seen in this courtroom that the way she is on television is the same person that she really is in person. But you know, she's also dealing with this thing every day that's been saddled on her because the Marriott gave out her room number and gave the room next door to her to this other guy without telling her. So you know, Erin Andrews on the one hand is living her dream, but at the same time, she's living a nightmare. And it's the nightmare part of this that you have to compensate her for. So how do you go about doing that? So I heard that statistic that Professor Jansen gave, that in the first 7 years, this has been viewed 16.9 million times, each one a separate individual viewing it, just in those first 7 years, and that in the 6 months before trial, it had been viewed once every minute and a half. Think of how many times it's been viewed since we've been sitting here in trial. And then think about the future. So I asked myself, supposing if they had to pay her just $1 for every time somebody goes on the internet and looks at her walking around naked in her hotel room, just for the past, you're already talking $16.9 million. And then if you look into the future, this is going to be with her till the day she dies. And what about the day that she has children, and one day her child comes home and says to her, "Mommy, somebody said that they looked at you naked on the internet. Is that true?" How does she handle that? Or does she decide to deal with that with her child before they ever start school so that they know ahead of time you might be hearing about that. I mean, think of what she is saddled with as people continue to catcall her in stadiums because they've seen her naked. So for the future, $1 a click, that's not very much. But it tells you everything about the magnitude of this harm and what your verdict should be to somebody who I consider to be heroic because she did not need to do this lawsuit, but she is holding them accountable, and now it's up to you to hold them accountable. That's sort of some of what I did in closing argument.
Well, if for our YouTube listeners or watchers, I actually handed Bruce my credit card. Actually, it's funny. A defense lawyer is that I always like to spitball, like, who are the lawyers you think are the best? And one guy told me that he thought Bruce Brillet was the best. And he said, man, I heard him give a closing argument. And I was defense counsel. He's like, I wanted to give him my check. I was like, I can't wait to use that line on the podcast every single time. So some other area we're going to just like pivot a little bit about, another practice area that has been growing and it's something your firm is handling, but skylight cases. What's going on with those? And I mean, something our firm hasn't taken on or done, but what are you seeing out there?
Yeah. We've handled a number of cases where workers and others have fallen through a skylight on a flat roof, a skylight that's big enough, a big plastic skylight, for somebody to fall through. These are catastrophic injuries and oftentimes death when they happen. What we began to learn in these cases was that this has been a problem that has been known in the industry since the late 60s. There have been so many people that have fallen through skylights to their death, so many workers, just workers, that have fallen through to their death, that the federal government began keeping statistics on this in the late 60s, early 70s, on the number of workers who fell through skylights to their deaths. It doesn't even include statistics of non-workers, and it doesn't include statistics of people who were brain damaged, paralyzed, or whatever. So I sort of feel like as lawyers more and more see that these are cases that maybe should be brought against various defendants, depending on the state, the jurisdiction, and the law at the time, that we may be able to push forward the cause of getting all these skylights guarded and protected. Because it is very dangerous up there for workers on flat roofs that are servicing air conditioners and so on. One misstep, one trip, one slip, and their lives and the lives of their families change. So I want to encourage people to look at those cases carefully.
And who are the defendants that you're looking at? I mean, obviously they're working at the time, most of the time.
Yeah.
So you can't sue their employer, so it's who are the people that you're targeting in those situations?
So it depends on the law in the jurisdiction and the facts of the case. Depends on the age of the building, who the contractor was that built it, who the architect was that specified things for it. The owner of the building sometimes, what they know or knew. In some of these cases, we've been able to develop that they knew an awful lot about this issue, that they've been warned about this issue. There are companies that started back in around 1970 who specialize in nothing more than building guards for skylights.
Since the 70s.
Since the
70s. It's still happening.
And this is still happening. There's a statistic that some people try to use, I don't know if it's accurate, that only 20% of the skylights in America are guarded. They should all be guarded. Wow. Why shouldn't they be guarded?
And how expensive is it to guard it?
It's pennies against the potential lawsuit. It's not a complicated guard. It just fits over the top. It emits light very easily. Sometimes they're called cages. And you can look it up on the internet, skylight guards, skylight cages, and you'll see some of these companies. And they're profitable, and that means people are buying them.
Well, we do have a couple. We had some pre-submitted viewer questions. They knew you were going to be on the show. The first one asks, it says, Bruce, are you concerned about Notre Dame's linebackers this season? It's actually from the Murray J 1234. I mean, that's you, Barat.
That is me. It said, if you had any questions for Bruce, please submit. And I went ahead and did it. I'm glad you guys got a chance to pick that question.
I'm concerned every year.
And we also have another question. It did ask, how does Bruce speak so clearly? Is it a trick?
No.
Practice.
Yeah, I mean, did you always do that, or is it something you made it?
All right, there is a little story. There's a story from eighth grade.
Oh.
You want to hear it?
Yeah.
Okay, so eighth grade, Blessed Sacrament School in El Paso, Texas. And at the end of the summer, each of us was required to get up and give a 3-minute speech about what we did that summer. So I got up and gave my 3-minute speech, and the teacher sat in the middle of the classroom. I can still see it right now. And the teacher at the end of each 3-minute speech would give a little critique of what the student had just done. The critique for me was, Bruce, I counted the crutch word, 55 times in your speech, and I was mortified. So I decided when I became a freshman in high school that I was going to join speech and debate, that I was going to change all that, and I figured the best way to do it is if I speak slowly and clearly so that my mouth and my thinking are in sync with each other. So by going a little slower, I can capture what I'm actually thinking, and that's sort of the genesis of that. Thanks to my eighth
and
grade
it doesn't
teacher.
Doesn't hurt. You're from Texas.
Yeah, well, yeah. I still say y'all.
So, Molly, I'm going to ask you this question. What advice do you have? We're going to be wrapping up here soon. What advice do you have for younger lawyers that want to try cases to get to the level that you're at in 9 short years, graduating from the best trial law school in the nation, Pepperdine?
Obviously, yeah.
Obviously.
Pepperdine.
But you know, there's some other trial lawyers at your firm for Pepperdine.
Christian Nickerson also went there, and yeah. Jeff.
Vic George went there. Mm-hmm. Yours truly, duh.
I
mean,
I know.
Some very good people.
Tom Fair.
Yes.
Like, we're crushing
yeah.
it.
Oh, man, yeah. So what advice do you have, even starting in law school and going forward, just to accelerate your career to where you are today?
So I do the Pepperdine Preceptor Program, which yep. you mentor law students. I think I do the CALA one and the Wallala one, too. And the things I always tell my students are join CALA. Yeah. As a law student, join CAOC and go to these events, because there are going to be people like Bruce and you who are totally open to talking to younger lawyers and answering, or law students, and answering questions that they have, and take advantage of that and go watch them in trial. Like, find, get on the listservs and see when people are going to be in court and go down and watch, because I've learned so much from being in trial with Bruce. And, you know, I wouldn't be exposed to that at other firms. And that's really how I've learned. And, you know, you make mistakes and you see mistakes that other people make and how they bounce back from that. So I really think that being exposed to as many trial lawyers as you can is really the best thing you can do. And just work really, really hard.
Earn your stripes. So Bruce, you do not know this, but back when I started my practice, I went solo in 2009, started Simon Law Group 2010. 2009, I won a raffle when I went to CALA that summer, and I got to have lunch with your partner, Brown Green.
Oh, yeah.
Met down at a sushi restaurant, walking distance from your office. He gave me the tour, never met him before. Found out we both went to George Washington, as well as did Barat.
Mm-hmm.
Both big baseball fans. But the piece of advice he gave me, you know, when you're starting your practice, you want to be able to do what you want to do most of the time and get a good partner.
Yeah.
That you can bounce ideas off of, that could do other things.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was talking about you, Bruce. It might have been the other one.
Jeez.
I think he was talking about the Wheeler portion.
Yeah,
of.
I think so.
I mean, that's one of the best things about our firm is we all go to lunch together every single day, and we just spitball and talk about cases. And it's great to have perspective from another lawyer who knows nothing about your case that can either, like, bring you down a little bit or reinforce that you're going down the right way.
So, Bruce, how about some mistakes? Not that you've particularly made, but things that you're seeing that other young lawyers or other firms make that you think need to be cleaned up a little bit. What are your thoughts about that?
I'll tell you what my strongest recommendation is. You know, you only get to the other side of the pool if you let go and swim out into the water. Mm-hmm. When you're going down there to try your first case, it is so easy to justify a settlement. You can always, as my friend Carl Douglas said recently, figure out a reason the case should settle. Oh, the judge is bad. The jury panels are poor. I got this fact, that fact. You've just got to go down and try the case. And nobody does it better than you, and we all know that.
No, oh, that was the collective you.
You.
So I want to thank our special guests coming on today. Remember, any questions are media@justiceteam.com. You can reach these fine lawyers at their website. Could you please plug your website for us?
www.gbw.law.
Very nice. Scroll, find them, ask any questions. They're very open books. They were to me when I started my career. And, you know, just mentors in the community. You guys kick butt every single day. And you try cases a lot of us say no to. You have some wonderful, I mean, many trial lawyers of the year at your firm alone. You know, Christine Spagnoli, Bruce Brown. I mean, the list goes on. It's very impressive. So thank you everything you do in the community. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, no sleep till justice. Thank you for tuning into this episode of the podcast, the Justice Team Podcast. Thank you.
She keeps her depo outline in a pickle brain of hers. Deadly by design. Yeah. She's coming for your experts. A built-in death machine destroyer for the Justice Team. There's no deposition she will decline. A modern-day suffragette. Well-versed in death threats and occasionally nice. She's a depo queen. It's her pleasure to be mean. Dynamite with her questioning. Guaranteed to make you cry. Ooh, impossible to pacify. Interrogating with a smile. Wanna try?